hey, contractors, I'm hosting a web class that'll take the unpredictability out of your business growth. You see, since 2015, we've tracked the growth of over 1,500 businesses just like yours in one of the longest running analysis of successful contractors in North America. We had unrestricted access to their financials, their operations, their management decisions, their personal habits, and all their biases. And we did this for about 30 months per member that we worked with. And we uncovered six, I would say, pretty unexpected patterns shared by the most profitable 7-, 8-, and 9-figure contractors. So tune in to discover our findings and learn how to scale up your business without working more. Click the link in the description and I'll see you there. Hey everyone, welcome back to Contractor Evolution, the podcast by Breakthrough Academy. Let me ask you something. Are you building wealth or are you just building a business? Because a lot of entrepreneurs, those are kind of the same thing. Our guest today, Garrett Gunderson, has built and sold an Inc. 500 financial firm, authored multiple bestseller books like Killing Sacred Cows, interesting name, I know, we'll get into it, and What Would the Rockefellers Do? And now he teaches business owners how to change this outdated financial advice that we've had for like 100 years into building actual long-lasting wealth. In this episode, Garrett unpacks the myth of, or what we call sacred cows, that are keeping contractors stuck in survival mode. Listen in and learn how to build a life that you don't even want to retire from, all while taking care of your family for generations to come. If you're looking to build more than just profits, this one's a game changer. Let's dive in with Garrett. You're listening to Contractor Evolution, the podcast by Breakthrough Academy, where we systemize contracting businesses for growth. Keep listening to learn how the world's top contractors scale their companies, build killer teams, and make more while working less. Garrett, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on, my friend.
Thanks for having me. Look forward to this conversation, man.
You have done a lot leading up to even just us talking today, but I was reading a bit about you. I looked into your background. So it turns out you built a Inc. 500 financial firm. You then exited that. Yeah. You now teach others to help them find their own financial freedom. And I'm curious to know, like, why? What drives you in all of this?
Dude, this is hilarious. I'm just going to give you something unexpected. So I have someone on my team that created a AI chatbot with a bunch of my content. And he's like, I want you to ask this chatbot, like, I want you to ask what your shadow is, like what your insecurities are, you know, why do you do what you do? And it was pretty fascinating what it came up with. Let's see if I can just quickly pull this up, if it's still here. Here it is.
So it's analyzed you and your personality and the inputs you've given it. And it's telling you now, this is what's really going on with you.
And I'm like, it's kind of frightening that this is this accurate, you know? And yeah, I've never shared it. So I just thought this would be kind of fun.
Let's do it.
I'd already erased it. So I'll just have to ask it one more time. While we buy some time while I do this, but
you could summarize it for me too. Like what was the insight that came out of it?
Well, what it was basically saying is I don't feel like I'm enough at times and that I would consider myself lazy if I wasn't doing something and judging myself as being, you know, stupid. And like, to a certain degree, that's what initially drove me. And I had this ambition because I, as a young kid, just thought, man, I'm not good enough and I've got to prove it by making more money. And that was the initial driver. That's very limiting. You hit a ceiling in that mindset. So I've done a lot of personal work and, you know, looked at like what the motivations are and the limitations. And the limitation with that mindset is nothing's ever enough and you're never really present. It's always getting somewhere, which meant I wasn't very present as a husband, eventually not that present as a father. And I always kind of had this hidden agenda that I don't like to admit, whereas I was like, what could I, you know, what would happen in this relationship? Could we go somewhere, get something, do something together? What do they bring to the table? And so I wasn't in a place where I could truly see people, hear them, and provide the most value because it was always about what it was going to do for me. Now, at the time, I couldn't see that. I would never say that. I could never articulate that. But looking back, I could see like the amount of hustle, the amount of like saying yes to so many things that said no to other things that were really important. And my wife's just an advocate for a quality of life that matters and pointing out like, is this really what you want? And being patient and kind of holding up the mirror. So it was, I'm very grateful for that. And it's been super helpful. And I'm imperfect in that, like, I'm still working through not always trying to be a good guy, and that good guy mentality sometimes is not doing what's best for me in the name of like serving other people at my expense. And so that's like a people pleasing, that's like a insecurity. And I've really been standing for my value lately, and that is messy and it's hard. And, you know, it's like telling people no sometimes, or that doesn't work for me. In the past, I'd just be like, oh, I'll just deal with it, right? And then they'd be like, oh, Garrett's so generous. Well, there's a difference between generosity and being taken advantage of. So I've had to go through lessons in my life through that. And what I've found is if I didn't learn the lesson the first time, it got harder the second time. If I didn't learn it the second time, it got harder the third time. So it's just about, you know, I can leave someone else somewhat empowered, but their reaction isn't my responsibility. That if they're being a victim in something, me compensating for that creates entitlement, and that's not healthy for any parties involved. But that requires difficult conversations. That requires saying no sometimes.
You sound like almost every entrepreneur I work with, and you also sound like me, man. I think we've all got this in us where it's just like we want to prove it to the world, then we want to prove it to ourselves, then we just want to prove it, and we get a rush out of it, and we trap ourselves, and we put a lot of weight on our shoulders based on other people's expectations. So sounds like you're working through what even I'm working through, man.
Behind every success is trauma, is compensation to some degree. You know, it's like, am I enough now? How about now?
And we never will be. So
unless we just accept it as is, right? And it's weird that as I got older and I sold my business, which I thought I had separated my identity from that business, but I didn't know how much identity was still wrapped up in it. And I just found myself in a place of victimhood. And I was like, that's like disgusting. I would write that you don't want to be a victim. And I was like regretting certain things and felt taken advantage of. And I was like, no, this was actually a lack of leadership. This is a lack of maturity. This was trying to provide homeostasis instead of actually addressing the hard things. And so now I get to look back and say, okay, what could I cultivate and learn from that? Because it was pretty expensive. You know, it cost me millions of dollars in mismanagement. But at the time, I just thought I was being a team player. And so that's the confusing thing sometimes, is we're doing the best we can with the information provided. And then hindsight's 20/20, or we think it is. But even then, it's still our interpretations. It still comes from a lens of, you know, whatever our feelings and emotions are, or whatever our regrets are, or whatever those might be. And so I always find, like, when I write a book, it's philosophical, and then I actually experience some of the things that I write in real time. And everything is easy when there's no stakes, but when the stakes are high, whew, it's like, okay, I'm going to learn. This is a hell of a teacher.
You're kind of doing this as almost like a self-help for yourself too. Like, you're not just writing these books or putting out this information for people to help them. You're doing it because you're also wrestling with it, and you're wanting to find answers, and you're going after it in a way where you're expressing it to others, teaching basically, and teaching, learning through your teachings.
Yeah, that's why I don't use AI to write.
You just use it to analyze who you are. That's all.
Yeah, I use it to tell me what's wrong with me. It's just weird timing that, you know, he keeps saying, the Steven on my team, he's like, dude, you would be amazed at, you know, what this is coming up with because of how much content I fed it from you. He's like, just try it out. And I just have my wife ask it questions today, and it was pretty accurate. There's things that would use that I would never say, like risk tolerance. I don't really believe there's risk tolerance. I think risk tolerance is a misnomer that people, if they think risk equals return, they're riskier. And the key is mitigating risk and managing risk, and what's risky to one isn't risky to another. Like, we have our own like values and abilities and passions, and I might see something someone else can't quite see, and so it may look really risky to the outside, but to me it's actually very natural. It's very much like part of who I am. And so I think that's one of the hard things is, as an entrepreneur, sometimes you have these voices of caring, loving people that don't really have the right information to guide you. And maybe it's because we want their love and respect, or we don't want to create worry for them, that we get trapped in dogma. And that dogma can be very misleading. And that happens a ton in finance. I know a lot of entrepreneurs that they do things irrationally with their finances because other well-intentioned people tell them that's the thing to do, but their life is so different.
You're touching, and we're going to get into this, a ton of principles. This is one of them that's in your book, which is, when I was listening to it, I was kind of like, this is what I would call, like, informed risk versus uninformed risk tolerance. Like, knowing what you're actually getting yourself into versus going to a 10X growth conference and being like, let's go, and just being like 10X on everything, and you get yourself into a big mess.
More, bigger, better, faster now.
the American dream. I felt this too for myself, where I'm like, there is such a difference between when I can calculate, understand, have experience in something, than when I'm just excited and I'm just going off an emotional high trying to change my life and go and wreck it all really in the process because I'm going too fast and things I don't understand. So you write a lot about this, which I found really interesting. And let's get into this a bit, because this is what I really want to get into today's podcast. But you wrote a book on killing sacred cows. And
yeah.
Really what it is all about is there's these like deeply held beliefs that we all have about money that have really kind of been taught to us by society. And you're kind of like, no, these things like are not that good for you, actually. And you need the opposite of this, or you need to think about this fundamentally different and kill these cows, which I thought was a really interesting analogy. But like, let's just start there. Like what is a sacred cow, and why do we need to kill these things?
Well, this is what's difficult about a sacred cow, is that everyone buys into it as a belief. And when looked at through that false belief, everything reinforces it. So enough people in society believe it. Like, this isn't my quote. It was a philosopher that said, if 50 million people say a foolish thing, it's still a foolish thing. And the problem is the people that we learn from, and the ideas and the memes and the cliches and the culture and the zeitgeist all tell us, no, this is how it goes. And it takes someone to actually ask better questions. And I think people that know how to ask amazing questions are our future, because if you can formulate the right question, you can find the answers that most people can't get to. And so these sacred cows are very subtle. They're not obvious until they are. Like if someone reads that book or listens to it, I call those nine myths the elusive obvious. Once I point it out, it's like, well, of course, that makes total sense. But without that information, it's kind of like in the Bible where people were worshiping these sacred cows, right? These golden calves. And they're just like, nope, this is what we do. And then someone goes, why? That doesn't make sense. And then all of a sudden that question starts to become very disruptive to these sacred held beliefs. And there's so many of them that, you know, when I was writing this book in my 20s, I was reading stories about people that would chain elephants, and then they would eventually remove the chain and put a string and the elephants would stay, because, you know, or they'd put a gnats in a jar and they'd put a lid on it, but they could take the lid off eventually and they'd never jump out because they were so used to there being a ceiling. Or people were cutting off the sides of a ham because that's what their great grandma did, because the ovens weren't big enough. And then they just thought it was part of the process. And we go through that kind of that rhetoric when it comes to our finances, and it leads us to limitation. And often what it does is it abdicates responsibility. It puts all of our you know, financial strength in someone else's hands, and we're uninformed, and that not even uninformed, misinformed. Therefore, we're not getting the results that we truly desire. And it leads us in a place of uncertainty, frustration, and ultimately taking far too much risk. So I can't believe I wrote that book in my 20s, man. It's like I just rewrote it in 2023 because I was like, well, it's kind of old. I should update it. And as I was rewriting it, I started from scratch. I didn't use like an existing Word document, and I was keeping so much of the original writing. The only difference was I learned to make, I'm a better writer now. I made it more about the reader. It was a very redundant first version of the book where, you know, my publisher's like, we need more words because then the spine's bigger and people see it on a bookshelf. I'm like, do people still go to a bookstore and buy stuff off the bookshelf? So I just shortened it and made it more succinct and added this component called investor DNA. Investor DNA really solves a lot of things in finance. See, the risk isn't in the investment, it's in the investor. So you either become a better investor or you take too much risk investing in things you don't know about. So once you discover your investor DNA, you can eliminate 80% of the complexity around finance and pay attention to what matters for you. And so adding that element was really critical. But the way I wrote the book was I just started listing, like, what are all the beliefs that we have? And I just wrote down these kind of memes, like, it takes money to make money. People say it all the time. You're in it for the long haul. People say it all the time. A penny saved is a penny earned. We heard that from Benjamin Franklin. Like, all these things. I'm like, is that true? And in what context would that be harmful? And I just started to write about it. And it took me, you know, several years and a lot of lost money to figure these things out. And I think that's why I was able to write it at an early age, is because I started investing when I was 18 years old. And I made some mistakes, because first I invested and did really well. And I thought, dude, I am so smart. But it was just timing. It was just luck. And I confused luck with skill. And I started to really find that out with a few things that started to happen. And that book became like really relevant because it launched in 2008, right at the time that people started to feel right. The impact of these myths. So they were paying attention. They're like, wait, I'm doing what everybody says, but I'm not in a good place. And so I think that's why it hit New York Times, is it was just the right timing for that message.
You know, I've seen this in my own life where I'm like, I understand contracting really well. I've been doing it for 20 years. I understand small business really well. We've been coaching it for many years. I understand real estate actually decently well. I've bought and sold lots of little properties. I've done like mostly through my personal portfolio, but like I've made money in all of those things. But then my buddies are like, well, we're doing crypto and you got to check this thing out. And I'm like, I really should like learn crypto. And I take half an hour, 2 hours trying to understand it. I open up a wallet and I just I don't even know where the money is anymore.
Here's the good news. 90% of crypto won't exist in the future.
Interesting.
Or more. Maybe 95%. Back in the 90s, there was this thing called internet stocks. And people bought internet stocks. Now, we know that Amazon made it through. We know that, you know, Facebook, you know, made it through. We know Google made it through. There was a few of these juggernauts that matter today. But most of the companies that everybody had these cliches, like, the, you know, the internet, that's the revolution. And Warren Buffett wasn't investing in the internet because he didn't understand it. And yet he's still a 22% a year investor, one of the wealthiest people in the world, because he stuck to his investor DNA. He had this analogy where he watched a documentary about Ted Williams, the baseball player, and Ted Williams batted over 400 one season, like unprecedented. And he said, the reason I did is I was selective with my pitches. I didn't swing at certain strikes because they weren't in my zone. And I just got so clear about what my zone was. And I think that's with investing. Investor DNA is your zone. So if you're good at this type of real estate, that's a good investment for you. For me, it might not be a good investment because maybe that's just not where my skills are, or maybe that's not where my interests are. And so that might be really risky for me. Now, there's certain real estate that's really good for me because I know the area where my cabin is. Cabins never go up for sale. There's only so much available on the river. I bought a second cabin that wasn't for sale by simply marketing to my neighbors and saying, hey, do you know anyone that's ever going to sell? And someone said, I'm selling in 3 years. And I said, what if I bought it now? So you had the cash and I just rented it to you for 3 years. He's like, great. Now that property's gone up in value. I know that area, but you know, I bought property in other areas. I didn't know anything about the area and I didn't know anything about that type of real estate. I just thought, well, real estate's a good investment. And it cost me, it was a distraction. I had to meet with, you know, everything from bankers to attorneys, to property managers, to maintenance people, never feeling inspired. So my real estate became books. I've written 10 books. I have an 11th that's a manuscript. That's my real estate. That's why my investor DNA. Other people, that's not the right thing for them.
And you know what's so interesting about this is when you go meet with financial advisors or you go meet with someone that wants you to buy, say, a multiplex and invest, like this is their education that they're selling to you and imposing their thoughts on you. And you're kind of following it because they're telling you this is going to be great for you. But if you don't know anything about what you're getting yourself into, the odds are stacked against you. The house is stacked against you. And it's a statistical average is what you're talking about. You're not saying it's going to go bad or not going to go bad. It's just how do you stack the odds in your favor? It's doing things that you have an intrinsic, unique position in that you not even just real estate. It's like in this area, I know my neighbor. There's an opportunity here, which goes back to something I remember years ago was taught to me, which is like, Danny, money doesn't make money. Creativity makes money. And what you're speaking to is not just like, oh, let's be super creative here. Like, let's stay within the realm of things I know and then find opportunity within that. Is that kind of what we're talking about in this entire book?
I think you nailed it. I think you just summarized it. There's no reason for people to read it now, dude. You did too good of a job.
Well, we got more. I've got more in here.
I took 200 pages to say what you just said in a paragraph. I like it.
I've got some of your principles. You have a lot of them, but I wanted to pull out a few that I thought were good. That's things good that even I still to this day struggle with, and I think a lot of us do. So let's start with this first one, abundance versus scarcity. Can you unpack that a little bit for us?
What's crazy is when people are in scarcity, they believe it to be reality. They don't see it any other way. And a lot of times it's because they don't like what's happened or what's happening. So they move into justification. And I call it the consumer condition, like a disease of the mind, where they look to take more value than they give. And if they're more about what happened in the past and trying to hang on to that versus create a more exciting, compelling future, it's typically coming from scarcity. Scarcity is fear, doubt, and worry. Scarcity is a belief that billionaires are bad, that you know, profit is evidence of deception and coercion, and that money is the root of all evil. That kind of scarcity puts people in a dilemma where they're damned if they do and damned if they don't. It's kind of like, I know someone that said, oh, they don't need that much of a home. That's crazy. That's like, I'm like, well, who determines need? Who determines value? Value is a perspective. And when people come from scarcity, they project on others. They justify their actions and they say things that aren't true, but they say them in protection of themselves. Like I have people say, yeah, I don't care about cars. That's why I don't drive that nice of one. I'm like, you wouldn't tell me that if you truly didn't care. You just maybe feel embarrassment, guilt, or shame about not having something nicer, and you're projecting that so I don't think something about you, but that's just some form of scarcity that comes out in our conversation. When people are in scarcity, they're usually in blame. They're usually talking about politics over, you know, production. They're talking about what everyone else is doing wrong instead of doing something right. That's the issue with scarcity, is it doesn't lead to responsibility or action, and ultimately is devoid of value creation, or at least it minimizes the value creation.
Yeah, it misses the opportunity of like, how can we? You're saying why we can't. And you're just focused on what
like,
we can't.
I can't afford it. Well, what would it take to afford it? Completely different mindset, right? Like, what amount of value would you have to create? How many people would you have to serve? How deeply would you have to impact the people you serve? It's a matter of being able to have a vision and then work towards that vision, even if you don't know how to achieve it the moment you say it. Most people will only say what they know how to achieve, limiting what the results are going to be.
When I was 18 years old, I started my first business, and I remember that feeling of like, I can't do this. It can't be done. We have too much work. Painters aren't doing a good job. I remember calling my coach, and he's like, Danny, you need to stop looking at what you cannot do, and you need to start asking, how can we? And, you know, I still to this day struggle with this. I grew up on $800 a month on welfare with my mom. And that was like single mom raising me and my sister. It still to this day plagues me, because all I saw in my younger years was all the reasons we couldn't do things, and all the reasons I couldn't buy that chocolate bar, and all the reasons like we can't have the nice things in life. And I'm 38 now, and I still struggle with that mindset. That still plagues me. And the only thing that gets me through it is just like constantly, well, two things. One, trying to bring myself to feel safe is actually an interesting thing. It's just like, what do I actually need and have in life? And how can I like feel safe in those things? And two is what we might talk about on abundance mindset, but it's like, I need to shift the language to how can I? I don't even have to have the answer. I just need to start asking that question. Yes.
Semantics matter. Like, I wrote this rap. It's a 5.5 minute rap that it opens my comedy special. My comedy special is called The American Ream. And it's all of the juxtapositions around money. It's all the phrases that limit us around money. And when you start thinking about money, most people associate with dirty, filthy, bad, you know, all these kind of things. And so they feel bad for wanting more. But part of it is money is just like a receipt. It's an evidence of value creation. So the goal isn't just saying, how do I make more money? It's really, how do I create more value? And the way that we do that is really we have to develop our mental capital, our ideas, our knowledge, our wisdom, our insights, our strategies, the tools that we have. And then we have to improve our relationship capital, the people, networks, organizations, team members, clients, you know, family, friends. And so business is that juncture. It's the bridge between mental and relationship capital. So the more that we use our ideas to improve people's lives, the more money we make. And so money is just a byproduct of value creation. So if people aren't where they want to be financially, it's a mental capital issue, their frameworks, their philosophies, or relationship capital issue. They're around naysayers and people that are so deep in scarcity that they drag people down with them. And so it's hard to manage relationships, because what if you have a deep desire to be liked by everyone? Well, you're not going to be, especially if you're doing a podcast or putting your stuff out there. You know, I've got some good haters out there, and you know, I get it. Like, I'm threatening their way of life because I'm speaking something that is different than maybe how they view the world, and they're justifying how they view the world in order to stay safe, right? And I might be threatening that, because we might learn, like in Sacred Cows, all right, when you don't know something and you're moving forward, you're like, all right, you don't know any better. Once you know better, now you have to actually make a choice. And so for some people, they'd rather justify and fight than to adopt a new belief system and change course. It's just, you know, I think the deep desire of safety that people have is that you think about companies that aren't doing good things in the world, and there's good people working for those companies. They don't ask enough questions to know whether it's really, truly good. Like, my dad was a coal miner. I don't know whether coal is good or bad, but most people would say it's dirty, right? And it's not the most efficient energy. But coal miners wouldn't want to say that, because that's what they know. Yeah. That's the work that they do. And I guess there's like a myopic view of not thinking about how they could do other things and feeling stuck. And so they justify that. And that's what scarcity does, is it's a justification machine.
I think as we get older, we do more of this. And I think I see people in their 60s, 70s, 80s that are either like struggling and they're angry at the world and they blame the world. And then there's those who are at peace and they're just kind of there being like, the world was amazing. I had an amazing life. And they both could have optically, if you look down at them from a spaceship and watch their life, could have had a similar series of events, good and bad, happen to them. But it was their perspective around it that changed their enjoyment of the whole thing.
Perspective. I mean, that's the key, you know. It's like, I had a mentor once that told a story about these shoe salesmen that, you know, they go out and they both come back and they're like, and it's early North America. They're like, hey, these Native Americans don't wear shoes. And the one was like, it's amazing. You know how many people don't have shoes? There's so many people. So there's like, they don't have shoes. Like, what are we going to do? Right. It's like just a totally different perspective. One sees it as they're defeated by it. And the other one's like, there's massive opportunity.
It's a lot of Nikes here.
So it's just, it is perspective, and perspective determines our action. And if we're in an abundant perspective, we're going to lead with innovation and ingenuity. We're going to have value creation at the helm. We're going to find ways to deliver value in unique and meaningful ways. And we're going to look for ways to solve problems. And most importantly, if you're abundant, you take responsibility. You're not going to control every thought, every circumstance, every difficulty, but you do have an option to learn and say, what are you going to do from a behavior standpoint? What are you going to do about it?
Just for everyone listening, because I struggle with this. It sounds like you do a little bit too. It's like we all probably do at some level. Like we struggle with getting into scarcity mindset, especially when things get tough, especially when things are on the horizon.
Well, everybody, when life's good, it's easy to be abundant. When everything's going completely your way.
Yeah.
But what do you do when it doesn't? So when there's a cash flow crunch.
Yeah. Or, and it was just like, welcome to reality. You're an entrepreneur. But like, so I deal with this too. Is there any like just tips you would have for everyone listening? Like, or even what you do to be like, this is how I pull myself out of this a bit.
I'll give it like three things that I think are really effective. So if I find myself in scarcity, I just get vulnerable with the people I trust, whether that's mentors, peers, or my wife. I think when a lot of business owners get into scarcity, they think the only solution is to isolate and work harder. And for their spouse, they're going, why are you distant? What's going on? Like, you're never around. And it creates this additional tension. And that's why they feel guilty for not being at home, but they feel guilty when they're not working because they're not getting ahead. So simply acknowledge it. Like, when we tell the truth, miracles happen. The second thing is, I like to add value to someone else's life when I'm in scarcity. Rather than get into the victim story, I like to just go, who has amazing energy that if I just call and I just do something good, they acknowledge and appreciate, and I build that relationship capital. So I simply like take action in a positive manner. And the third thing I do is I write. I'll just write and I like process my emotions. And I'll say, what am I protecting, defending, or trying to control? I'll say, what have I yet to accept? What would I have to forgive in order to get through this? And then what could I state that is already great and abundant? And how can I choose love in the face of this adversity? And that's really helpful to sit down and just, I'll get out my Remarkable, which is a little pad, and I'll just write the answers to that, you know? And it just helps me to feel the emotion and go through the emotion rather than bottle it up. So I'm not jailed by those emotions. So I'm not trapped in that scarcity, because scarcity, I write books about it, but I'm not impervious to, I mean, I have scarcity in my life that comes up, you know, like I sell my business and then I'm like, okay, I'm going to start over. And I go, can I do it again? Like, why did I sell the business? And where did I go wrong? And how come I'm not further along? And what about my other friends that are all worth hundreds of millions of dollars? And why am I, you know, like I get those moments, those thoughts enter my mind. And if I stay alone with those thoughts, I remunerate in those thoughts and it becomes worse. If I actually do one of those three steps I talked about, I tend to elevate and appreciate and good above those things. So,
Garrett, what you're talking about is so important, because I think so many entrepreneurs have that first goal of like, one day I'll get to the point of financial freedom, or I'll sell the business, or I'll, and it's a mirage, isn't it? It's a mirage. And I've heard this from so many people, and it's just, they get there and then they realize that's not the fulfillment they were looking for. If anything, there's a new layer of depth of like, depression. And like
73% of people that sell their business regret it.
Yeah.
It's a thing that they know. It's a thing that they've created value for. And all of a sudden, you know, the phone stops ringing or whatever it is. They're getting less messages. They feel less validated in their work. And then now they, you know, even worse, a lot of them make a lot of money and then they just blow it. They go invest in things they know nothing about. And those things don't always work out because they have an abundance of cash. And now they go from a skill set that they understand to a skill set that they don't when they become an investor instead of a business owner. And, you know, it's like, look, I went to Italy for a summer and it was an amazing summer, but I was also ready to come back and get to work. Like, I find value and fulfillment in serving others. I love when someone reads my book and talks about it. Like, that feels good. If I'm just sitting around, like, I just like to do things along the way, like have hobbies, like enjoy life, create some parameters, not be completely addicted to only working. And I don't want to wait till one day, someday at a specific age to be like, okay, I'm ready to enjoy life, because then I just miss out on so many great memories along the way. And it's a skill set and a muscle we have to develop. I think entrepreneurs, it's our tendency to continue to work more and get bigger and scale. But if we don't have boundaries and we don't know what it is that we're up to, and if we're just doing things that we hate in the name of making more money, that becomes very exhausting. And it becomes this relentless pursuit that could never fulfill and bring us true joy unless we fall in love with the work or the people that we work with.
That's good. That's one of these principles I want to talk to you about today, which was the retirement myth.
Yeah.
Can we talk more about this? Because we're already talking about it. What is it? This is like dream that we have, and then we get there and we're super disappointed. And you're right. A lot of us, I'll say this actually, let's rewind the tape a little bit before we even get to this place of selling the business. A lot of us start the business being like, this is what it could be. And then we get ourselves trapped in what you're talking about, which is 80 hours, 60 hours a week of work of stuff that's just grinding. And we've lost the fun. Why does this happen to us?
As I mentioned, we don't really have boundaries. And I didn't. You know, my wife said for a while she felt like a single mother because I was just always saying yes to every speaking engagement. And so I missed a lot of important dates and important memories because I was on the road. And I could have just redefined what that looked like. I could have said, well, the constraint is I'm not reaching enough people. The solution is there's technology. And once she confronted me about it, I started doing more, back in those days, teleseminars. I started doing more webinars. Now when people ask me to speak, I'm like, it's 25 grand, or if you want it virtual, it's 2,500, and I'm 90% as good virtually as I am in person. And a lot of people take that option, and it means I'm still with my family. I also say, I only go on 2 trips a month for speaking. So I limit what that is so that I still have time for other things that are really important. If we don't create our boundaries and define our parameters, then it's always a play-to-win game. And it's always something about the future at the expense of today. But I believe wealth is our ability to be present and be fulfilled. And so my wife, when I was, you know, I wouldn't call myself retired. I was just basically doing comedy after selling my business. And that was super fulfilling for a while. And then eventually it was like, yeah, this isn't fulfilling enough to make it a career. She's like, you do well on stage where you're really impacting someone's life. So why did you completely remove that? And I was like, yeah, why don't I just say I do that, you know, twice a month. And I wrote a one-man show because it was more creative and more compelling and more connected and more challenging. And so I just redefined. And that's what's cool is I have this belief that we win when we play. So how can we make work feel more like play? It's not going to be that way each and every day. But if it's more consistently like that, then the win is in the work. It's not just in the outcomes. We've become addicted to outcomes. We want this achievement, this award, this net worth, this acknowledgement. And if instead, like one of my favorite books is The Creative Act by Rick Rubin, where he talks about the actual process of creation is the win. It's the art is for the artist, first and foremost. And then whatever happens after that is outside of your control to a large degree. And if you can fall in love with the process, then you can love your life. In entrepreneurship, we get in love with the outcomes. And then when we get there, they feel a lot more hollow than expected. 1 week, I made New York Times and Inc. 500 the same week, but I lost 200 grand on a real estate deal. So I didn't celebrate. My wife found out about New York Times and Inc. 500 from someone on my team and last minute tried to throw a little, you know, get together for it. And I just was depressed and sad because I'm like, how could I be this dumb to write a book and lose 200 grand? And so I was more focused on what didn't work than what was working. And again, I was only doing real estate because I was trying to build net worth, which nobody really knows your net worth. And yet most of us wrap our self-worth in it to a very large degree, this invisible number that, you know, doesn't necessarily translate to your quality of life. Because even if you get there, someone else has more, then you go, well, I'm going to raise the stakes. And then, oh, there's inflation. I should even do more. And why don't I do? It's like this kind of internal dialogue that comes from that lack of knowing what game we're playing. So I'd say if we design a game worth playing, we've already won. It's just that most people are playing the wrong game.
You wrote in your book, build a life you don't need to retire from. And I was like, that is very smart and not something that a lot of us do well. And I will say I did my best even along the way. We've been doing Breakthrough Academy for 10 years. And one of the rules we put in place is we're not going to do this working weekends. And we pretty well have, which is amazing. But it does creep in. And there has been times where I break that rule and I break it for too long. And I start to go and I work till 7 instead of being done at 5:36. And it starts to gnaw at you. And suddenly you're in a path where you're like, I'm a year into doing it this way and I'm not having the same amount of fun I used to have. I'm not building the life, what do we say? Building the life that I would never want to retire from.
Yeah, part of that is being so committed to your rules that you don't violate them will actually build confidence and bring joy. It'll also bring resourcefulness. We become better delegators when we create parameters. A lack of parameters, our insatiable appetite for more will overtake intelligence. And what I mean is we'll start doing the work other people could do that's not our best work in the name of just getting things done. Look, this is when I learned this at the deepest level, is in 2006, we had a little private plane and my business partners died in a plane crash. And I just made this commitment erroneously, like, I'm going to do everything it takes to keep all 42 employees and keep this thing going, which meant I neglected my health. I gained 25 pounds over 4 months. I didn't ever see my one-year-old son because he was asleep when I left for work in the morning by the time I got home late at night. And I mean, my wife and I, like, I was just absent until I finally got my first day off. It was driving on Thanksgiving Day to visit my family 2 hours away. We're in the Bentley, so we've got the demonstration of how wealthy we are. And my wife's driving because I'm so damn exhausted. And halfway through the drive, we hadn't even said a word to each other. And then she finally broke the silence at a stoplight. She goes, she looks at our son in the back and she goes, you know what? You're pretty extraordinary at business, but you're ordinary as a father and a husband. Mm. And she was right. I mean, I was speechless, if you can imagine me not talking, and got emotional. And I was like, all right, it's time to do something different. And that's when we created these rules. I said, okay, if I'm gone more than four nights in a month, I'm taking a day off that we could just hang out as a family. You know, I'm going to leave my computer in the office. I'm never bringing it out of the office. It doesn't go anywhere else in the house. You know, I'm going to set my phone aside. Like, I just started creating these rules that allowed for the addictions to go away, that allowed for the parameters to say, I'm going to be present with my family. And it took time. It took overcoming. It's like an addiction. So it wasn't easy at first, but it was rewarding. And what I learned was during that 4 months, I had what economics would call diminishing marginal productivity. I was spending more time and getting less done because I was exhausted. And if we don't manage our energy, time doesn't equal result. Value equals result. And if we diminish our ability to create value because of exhaustion, because of guilt, because we don't feel like we're doing the other right things, because we're not taking care of our health, because we're not with our family, that all starts to implode. And I just became much more masterful at delegating and saying, all right, I'm going to delegate roles to people that they get to own instead of just giving someone a task. And not everything that needs to be done now. So I just created parameters where I said, all right, what something is going to be done now lives in my calendar, not as a task list. There's a beginning and end time. There's things that I'm not doing now, which means I have the next 2 weeks that doesn't live in my calendar. I revisit week to week and I can put it in the calendar when it's time, but I want to get it done in 90 days. And then I just decided this was the big one. What am I never doing? What am I just going to say? That's a good idea, but not for me. And then I'm also going to have this place called the parking lot where I could still brainstorm. I could still dream, but it doesn't have to destroy bandwidth or other things that are important in my life. And I can revisit that from quarter to quarter. And half the parking lot dies over time because what seemed like a good idea in the moment wasn't necessarily as good an idea as I thought.
That happens all the time to me. Yeah, what you're saying is when the pressure cooker turns up and the game raises and you got to show up, instead of just going, I'm all in and just, you know, caveman, like, let's go.
Whatever it takes.
And that's what, dude, I do this all the time because I have this motto in my head that's like, I may not outsmart you, but I will outwork you, right? And it's an ego thing. And I've had to, as I get older, let go of it, but it's still not perfect. And what you're speaking to is this concept of you actually now need more boundaries than you've ever had because you're going to be tempted to go even harder than you've ever had because you're basically, you're hitting the, I would call it the dopamine button of like entrepreneurship, and you get a bit of a high out of the challenge and you want to go after it.
Yeah.
And you
win the booby prize. Basically, the world thinks a lot of you, but the people you love don't know you. Right. You know, I remember watching... I love the My Next Guest program with David Letterman on Netflix, and he interviewed Will Smith. He did the interview before Will slapped Chris Rock, but then it was released after the incident. And if you watch that interview, Will had an insatiable appetite that even if they were hitting records at the box office, he felt he could do more. And if you listen to his book, he talks about how much promotion he would do, and he would go do concerts and all over the world just to promote the thing. So he's using music and he's showing up everywhere. And it was inevitable that he would be so exhausted that he broke down, that he was at a trigger on something that most people don't understand. Like, dude, that was a joke. And you lost your mind. Because he was so committed to outworking everyone at all times that he lost himself.
In Canada, we call it gripping the stick too hard. Playing hockey and you're holding on too tight. So amazing. So
of course, if you're in Canada, you have to have hockey references, man. It's just part of the, you know, your DNA.
There you go. And this is actually, my whole team will laugh at me because I'm like the worst hockey player ever. But anyway, so let's get back to like finishing this thought, the retirement myth. It's that... freedom is basically based on the ability to design a life that you would want to continue to live, which is involving all the things you do in your business, not trying to get away from it and replace it with question mark. I'll figure it out later when I got a pile of cash. It's being able to live the life that you don't need to retire from, which is an amazing statement. And I think what you just said is it requires boundaries and it requires practice in creating those boundaries, because it's not just going to be like, I heard it on a podcast, so I've got boundaries. It's like, no, this is going to be a lifelong practice of boundary setting and enabling it to make sure it's not forgotten as things go up and down in your business and life.
I don't think that people understand just how detrimental of a philosophy retirement is. I mean, my buddy Derek Coburn just wrote a book called Let's Retire Retirement. We've been very aligned in this philosophy for a long time, been friends for a long time. But he just outlines it like on a case by case, like just details it. And he talks about if he had a time machine, would he go back and pay 50 grand to get in that time machine just to hold one of his kids when they were a baby for a day? He's like, I'd pay 50 grand for that moment. And he said, yeah, I traded it for $5,000 activities along. And I look at some people that have kids when they're older, they watch their friends make these mistakes and they actually are a lot more present with their kids. You know, they go, oh yeah, I think that we spend like 90% of our time with our kids when they live in our house. Then when they're out of the house, you only get 10% of the time, yet you worked so hard during the time they're in the house that you're like, oh, when I'm retired, I can afford to go anywhere with them, but they're not around to go anywhere with you. They learn from you just to work all the time and they've got their own stuff going on. And so, you know, if we just said, look, I'm not going to retire, I'm just going to create financial independence where I have enough cash flow for my assets to cover my expenses, then I can have a choice every day of if I work or not. And I can have choice to take time to just invest in my family or have a hobby or just enjoy the life along the way. And then retirement just becomes null and void because you just maybe work less as you get older, but you can actually work a little less now and just extend the time that you say your retirement age is and don't burn yourself out. It's just a different philosophy. Retirement's from the industrial age, man. That was a good idea if you're working on an assembly line 7 days a week and you know you're dying at age 65, so you get 3 years of retirement. Okay, I get it. But like in the world today, if you are doing stuff with your mind or you have a crew that's doing some of the work, like you don't have to always be the one with the hammer and the saw. Like, yeah, you're going to break your body down. Retirement starts to sound like a really good idea. So stop sacrificing your energy and your health and your life so that one day you can finally live a life you love when you're too damn old to enjoy it. You know, you can't buy back the memories you never have. There is no time machine. So the best thing you could do is say, what if I just redefine and recontextualize retirement and say, I'm just going to build this life that I really love and just build a financial structure? Because I think the finances get us to work even harder because we have this notion called wealth that didn't always exist. I mean, I guess, you know, we have all these financial instruments that didn't exist in the past, and now we have so much that we can store our value. And now we're saying, well, I want to retire at age 60, and now we live to 90. That's 30 years. That's a lot of pressure to create 30 years of cash flow if you didn't create cash flow with your investment philosophy. Most investment philosophy is save 10% of your money, chase the 10% rate of return, wait for 30 years. I'm like, well, what if you said, forget about accumulation, just create cash flow. Plug financial leaks, keep more of what you make, learn to create cash flow with your investments, and then you have so much more flexibility along the way.
Let's talk about this. This is the other principle I wanted to get into with you, which was cash flow versus net worth, which I'm guilty to say I downloaded an app called Monarch Money a few years ago, and it's really got me on this net worth thing because you can see it moving every day with all your assets and your depreciations and all those things. And then I read your book and you're like, cash flow. I'm like, I used to do that when I was younger. And then I've just like drifted from it and I focused on net worth for some reason. Tell me, like,
net worth's the vanity metric.
Yeah, let's talk about this. Like, get into this. Why is this so important to focus on cash flow versus net worth? And then, like, you're getting into it already, but like, what does it create for us when we do a good job of this?
Well, imagine if you had assets creating cash flow to cover your expenses. That means every active dollar you earn can buy more assets, or you could take a month off and everything's still paid for. If everything's locked in a retirement plan, creating zero cash flow, you have to keep putting money into that machine. And if you stop, you start to risk your net worth because you're going to have to cash in that cash in order to live. It's dangerous. I mean, I'd rather have a low net worth and really high cash flow than a high net worth and low cash flow. It's my preference because cash flow to me is like blood, where net worth's like muscle. It's, you don't want one versus the other, but if there is no flow, the muscle does no good. So like, cash flow gives you a lot more stability, security, options, and that recurring revenue is, you know, like I sell my business, so all of a sudden I don't have the cash flow I had in the past, but because I have the philosophies and written the books that I've written from 2024 till today, I've already created six figures a month in cash flow in just that short period of time because that was my focus. If I didn't have that focus, I might have millions of dollars in a retirement plan. I don't have a retirement plan. I don't have a RRSP or a 401k or any of that kind of stuff. I have $0 there because it doesn't abide by my philosophy. It doesn't help me to be more present. It doesn't help me to feel wealthier. It doesn't bring any value to me until I'm later age. Now, it doesn't mean I'm ill-prepared because I still have assets and those assets create cash flow so I could benefit now and in the future. That's the key. And I just have a lot more optionality because I have that cash flow, which means if I want to take a trip, I can take a trip. If I'm back in the day when I was only focusing on net worth, if I was on a trip, I'm like, man, I'm not earning anything right now. I don't have cash flow coming in because I was so attached to what activity I did was creating cash, that cash was building assets instead of, okay, I want cash flow with every asset that I acquire. And when that covers my expenses, I'm just in a much different place.
When you say this, are you talking about like active cash flow from my business that I have to work every day to go and make sure it continues, or passive cash flow, or both? And just either one?
Both.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I have a program called Multiplier and people pay $500 a month and, you know, we help them with their finances. I still teach every week in that. I want to teach. I like teaching. I like that community. So it is pretty active. I don't think there's many truly passive investments out there that perform well. If it was truly passive, why would someone pay you that much, right? Like it's going to be competitive. The more active we are up front, the more passive our investments can become. But if we're completely passive with our investments, we're just handing the money over to someone else. It's too competitive. Why would, you know, why would someone pay you 10% if they could just, you know, pay 5% for that? You know, it's private investments typically outperform public investments. Public investments are extraordinarily efficient. Private investments are extraordinarily inefficient, but also more dangerous if you don't know what you're doing.
I've found this over the years. I'm like, where do I park my money? Where do I put it to create little bits of cash flow? And when you really start to boil it down and you say, well, what if I was to like withdraw this? Oh, I got to pay tax on this. Oh, and then you suddenly like, this isn't great. Like it's kind of a myth that I'm going to have this pile of cash that's going to create cash flow for the rest of my life. It involves me. Everything that's been of value, just like you said, when you create value in the world, it'll bring back dividends. It's when you're trying to not create value and still like park it and retire, it's like you're going to get yourself stuck. So
you're going to limit yourself. I mean, I don't like putting my money in jail. And I think anything that's tax deferred, money's in jail, because if I go to pull the money out, if I hate paying taxes today, I'm going to hate paying them more in the future than now. I just find the older people get, the crankier they become a lot of times. You know, when I told my grandma she had to take her required minimum distribution at 70 and a half of her retirement plan, she was pissed because she didn't want to pay the taxes. Well, guess what? If you don't spend the money, it might as well be 100% tax, because deferral is not saving. And a lot of people defer things. And my problem is if people just put money in a retirement plan and then they retire, they don't have to become a cash flow expert without training themselves on how to create cash flow their entire lives. So now they're subject to three factors that are very detrimental. One, interest rate fluctuations. If someone retired in the year 2022, interest rates were exceedingly low. And so they weren't getting a lot of cash flow with on their assets because they typically moved to a more safe allocation like fixed income, like bonds and money markets and CDs and those kind of things. Well, then interest rates went up in 2023. They lost value on their portfolio and inflation came in a big way, right? Like double digit inflation, which started to eat away at their purchasing power. And then finally, what if taxes go up? If you sell your business, you just got rid of your best tax shelter and now you're going to be in a lower tax bracket when you retire. That is planning for failure. How are you going to be in a lower tax bracket? Less money, or the government's going to have to lower taxes. They're not really great at permanently lowering taxes because they have an insatiable appetite for spending. So I don't want to be subject to interest rate fluctuations, tax fluctuations, and inflation and not have control over that. That's why I don't want to sell the business I have now, because it's me. I'm part of the brand and I just want to build a business that I love. If people want to come and offer me money for it, it's because it's valuable, not because I should sell it. I mean, I want to just be involved and I want to be involved in the things I love to do, not the things I hate. And as time goes on, I keep delegating things I don't love and doing more of the things I do love. I tend to write more, do more podcasts, do more speaking. I tend to build high quality relationships that inspire me and uplift me. And I, you know, like I don't want to stop doing that. When I did stop doing that for a time, I wasn't that happy. I was happy, but not fulfilled.
There's a lot of people listening to this right now that are probably a little bit like, oh God, I've got this offer. I've got the, cause there's a lot of private equity coming into our space right now. And there's a lot of,
and private equity, I mean, let's be candid. Are they really going to treat your customers the way you want them to? Like, their whole model is, how do we strip value, not how do we create value? And the people that create value are the entrepreneurs. The people that, like, suck up all that value is venture capital. That's why they're snakes and referred to as being snakes. Like, I don't want them coming in and harming the very values that I created and the people that I serve just to make a buck. I think of, like, corporations that come in and, you know, they sell to venture capital, and then I'm a client of that. The client experience 100% of the time has gotten worse, not better. And I know people that sell to that and then they still have to be involved in an earnout, and they hate it because it's not how they want to run their business. And now they're in this really conflicted position. So, I mean, if you hate your business, then maybe it makes sense to sell, but what would it take just to build a business that you love working in?
You're very counterculture, Garrett. I like it. This is all the things. Yeah. All the things. I was like, wait a minute. I thought I just went to a conference where they told me how to do this. This is good. I personally had a question for you when I was prepping for this, and I do think probably others think about this as well. I hope they do. Investing in your heirs. So I have three little girls, 10, 8, and 7. They're growing up in a very different life than I did, right? I grew up on welfare. I remember I got in a car accident at 16 years old with my mom's car, and the bumper got all messed up. And my mom looked at me and she said, "That can't go through insurance. You have to pay for it yourself because we can't afford the premiums." So I had to spend all summer working my butt off, moving furniture and saving money. And it was the first thing that taught me real hard work, because prior to that, I would just get fired from jobs and I didn't really care. And I look at that, just that one principle I learned at a young age, and I'm like, how do I replicate things like that for my kids? Because it's different for them now. And is there any just thoughts you have around raising your kids in wealth?
You can pay for what they need, but have them at least pay half for what they want. Say, learn to earn. You know, I'd make my kids bid jobs. Like, they want money. I'm like, well, what are you going to do? And they would bid, and then they'd have to invoice me to pay. And a lot of times when they would give me outlandish bids, I'm like, I'm just going to do that myself. I'm good. And then sometimes they would underbid, and I'm like, cool, I'll take that. And then they'd learn, like, oh, damn, this, I way underbid this. And so, you know, to me, if I just gave them money, then the problem is they don't see the value of money. I also just think it's really important to be ready for the conversations when they're ready to have it, not force feed them. A lot of times on our drive to our cabin, I would give these dissertations and these, like, talks to my kids. And I think that's just in one ear and out the other. And here's dad talking. Last night, I was sitting down with my son and two of his friends, and they're asking me about Bitcoin. They're asking me about, you know, money. And I'm like, I just stayed up way past my bedtime just to have those conversations because it was on their time. There's family retreats that you can do. There's conversations that you can have. But I think if they just have everything that they want instead of them earning part of that, it creates entitlement and it creates a lack of appreciation, and it can create them being spoiled. It is a different game when you have money than when you grew up without money, and it's different challenges, and we're never going to be perfect and all that. But the key is, like, you've got to get them to at least participate in those earnings. My youngest works at Trader Joe's right now. My oldest is doing editing and video for me. It's a way I hope to indoctrinate him a little bit in these philosophies, because he has to watch the videos over and over again. You know, my youngest son's friends were, like, joking that about my books, and that my youngest hadn't read any of them. They're like, "Have you not read your dad's books?" I'm like, "Well, he's heard the talks over and over, but we'll take trips, and that's when they're ready to talk. So we have the conversations." And I just try to create these traditions that they want to come back and be part of. Summer Olympics with the family, Christmas roast where we tease each other, and then have a meaningful conversation, sometimes on 3x5 cards around the dinner table. And right now, we're just like, man, I don't know how much longer we have them at home. So we're really working on doing family dinners again. We got away from that. And by not having those habits and rituals, because when they're little, we always had on the drive to school, what were they grateful for? What would make it a great day? And what's their, you know, mantras and affirmations? And at the end of the day, my wife would say, what was your high today? What was your low? You know, what would you like to improve? So we had that kind of ritual that brought that in on a daily basis. So it's our rituals, it's our traditions. And then we actually have a family crest that we all worked on together that has symbols for who we are, what we stand for. It sits on top of our mantle at our house. There's a little one, you know, back here that was the original sketch. You just find those moments. And, you know, when it's time to have the conversation, have it.
You're talking about being very intentional and present, and it kind of goes to the other principles of, like, you need to create a life that you can do those things in. Otherwise it slips by you. Cause it can be tempting when you're busy as all hell and you're working 80 hours a week and you just want your kids to be happy, to give them what they want. Right. And it's the discipline to not, to actually go and do the work. I think about actually, and it's interesting too, you say like to give them the lessons when they're ready to hear them. Like I bought my kids tortoises about 6 months ago, like little baby tortoises. And I remember talking to them, I'm like, kids, like things going to outlive you. So you better A, make sure you actually want these things. And B, we're going to talk about responsibility. And we're going to talk about what it means to take care of these things. And I have three girls. All of them heard me say the same speech. My middle child was the only one that actually committed to it. She cleans their cage every single day. She's like focused on it. And she's like, Dad, I'm learning responsibility, because she heard me. The other two didn't care. The older one doesn't take care of the tortoises all. Younger one doesn't care at all. It's the middle one that she heard me for some reason. And I've seen a few of those instances where it's like, right, like I can be A, I have to create time to be intentional, but B, I can do that as much as I want. They have to be ready to hear it and they have to be able to come to me. So that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Okay. Just for time, Garrett, there's probably so much more. We should probably do another one. I don't know, 6 months, a year from now. Let's do another.
Sounds
one.
Great, man.
You've got so many good thoughts. Let's just get a few rapid fire things for you. I would love to know just like, what is your like sacred cow that you personally struggle to kill the most? Like, what's the one that you wrestle with the most?
Knowing my worth and standing for it. Just, you know, being willing to have the tough conversations and deal with the consequences. That's been a tough lesson for me.
What's your daily weekly practice that keeps you kind of like just focused on an abundance mode, keeps you moving forward? What are some of the key things that someone else could listen to and be like, that's a good tip?
Yeah. I just write in my 5-minute journal every day. What am I grateful for? You know, what is my intentions for the day? What are the things I want to reinforce in my life? I do a cold plunge and work out every morning, you know, so that's make sure that my body's in a good place. And then, I used to do more in the mornings. I'm not in a place where I'm doing the extra stuff. And I do a lot of writing first thing. Like I write in the mornings. I don't write well at night. So this morning I wrote for a couple hours. So I just try to do those things before I start my day.
All the things we're told to do, and very few of us do. Okay. Cool. I think you mentioned it earlier, but there's like a financial aptitude test that you give out that we could probably put a link in the description of. Can you just?
Yeah, people could just even DM me at Garrett B. Gunderson and we'll hook them up with a money persona quiz so they can understand where their blind spots are for scarcity and what their winning personas are. So they know how to like operate more in abundance and know what their like natural abilities are and how they kind of view things. And especially if they're married, having their spouse take it, because we don't marry the same money persona most of the time.
Just help us understand ourselves and how we perceive money. Is that kind of what it's doing?
Yeah. Super helpful. Yeah.
Send it to me too. I want to take it. I haven't taken it yet. Sorry. Right. I'll take it.
Awesome.
And if you want us to, we'll put a link in the description for everyone too. So they can just download it and take it from there.
You can do that.
Any final thoughts for everyone? This was a great chat, by the way. Thank you.
Yeah, great interview. Love the conversation. I think that progress over perfection, done is better than perfect. We're in this life to learn lessons, and you know, I look at it as wins or lessons. Like the only way it's wins and losses if we don't learn the lesson. That's the only way it turns to a loss. So celebrate the wins along the way, discover the lessons, and you know, be kind to yourself and realize you're going to make some mistakes. They don't make you less lovable; they just make you human. So. You know, as soon as you understand that, I think you'll be a little bit nicer to yourself.
I think there's a comfort too in just knowing we're all kind of in this together, like listening to you and the journey you've been on and knowing where I'm at and knowing where some of our listeners are at and my members that I work with. It's like, guys, like we're all kind of in this together. Like, and it's not like you're some like heathenistic, terrible person for not following certain ways of being. Like we all struggle with this and we're all working on it and it's not going to go away. And it's also, it can get easier over time. It's just like, it's a part of life though. And it's just, we got to move through it. And every day, just be a part of how we do things. So welcome to being an entrepreneur.
Well, thanks for having me, man. This was fun.
Thanks, Garrett. Okay.
It was great.
Have a good one. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Contractor Evolution. If you've already subscribed to our podcast, consider sharing this episode with another contractor that you think needs to hear it.